Bad news.
Bad news for the state.
Bad news for capital.
Bad news for patriarchy.
Bad news for all forms of domination.
Bad news. Angry voices from around the world.
Our monthly info show from anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio projects worldwide.
If these news are bad, I don't want to be good.
Hello, comrades. This is the 29th episode of Bad News, a counter-information radio show in English by the International Anarchist and Anti-Authoritarian Radio Network, broadcasting news and the movement struggles from all over the world. In December's episode, you are listening to an interview of A Radio Berlin about 1 year's anniversary from the Yellow Vests, from ex-workers, an audio about the situation in Chile, and from radio zones about demonstrations that took place all over the country and the telegraph from the state for the evacuations of the squads.
The Anarchist Radio Berlin recorded the following interview in November 2019 for the 1 year anniversary of the Yellow Vest movement in France. Since then, the social protests have intensified again with a huge general strike on December 5th with more than 1 million persons on the streets all over the country in a struggle against the pension reform by the French president Emmanuel Macron. But now, let's start with the interview from Toulouse, one of the strongholds of the Yellow Vest movement and French Gilets Jaunes movement.
Possibility to talk to Nico today. He actively took part in the Gilets Jaunes movement. I think right from the beginning he will tell us more about this. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you too.
Would you maybe like to present yourself and tell us something about your engagement in the Gilets Jaunes movement and your political background?
Okay, so I started to be an activist originally with a thing around free software, privacy, etc. And then I evolved to more social scenes, and now I am a communist and a syndicalist, a revolutionary syndicalist, and I also am an ecologist, and that is now my way, my aim, if I can say that. And in terms of theory, I am really influenced by Frédéric Laudon, that is mostly a Spinozist and a Marxist. But I have also taken some of the things from anarchists, like self-management. And I am also nearly vegan, and professionally, currently I am a computer scientist.
And I think in the Gilets Jaunes movement, you take part as an individual and not as part of an organization or something, because it's a movement of individuals, right?
And also nearly no organization really supports the movement at the beginning. So even me at the beginning, as it started from oil taxes, I was not, for an ecological point of view, it was not pleasant that it starts with that, even if I understand that there was a lot of more things behind this. I was not a first protester in the Gilets Jaunes movement. I started with a climate protest that did with the Gilets Jaunes, and then I continue with the Gilets Jaunes, even if there was the climate guys were not there anymore.
Okay, we just started to talk about Gilets Jaunes. I think most listeners will know it from the media coverage. I think there was a lot of also international media coverage earlier this year. But could you give a brief summary from your perspective, what signifies this movement and what makes it maybe special compared to former protest movements in France?
The root of the problem that the movement says it is that there are problems to live correctly. So it is not absolutely not about oil. Oil was just the one thing that was too much, but it covers a big forest.
The flame that lighted the fire, maybe.
Okay, maybe, no. But I may not know the English expression for that. I have one in French, but I don't know how to translate it. So, and there was something that is a bit special compared to regular protests. It is that the most Gilets Jaunes, or at least a lot, do not trust in a regular organization like union workers. They fear that it takes the power, etc., and they really prefer that they are away or not too much present, or they do not really trust in a regular organization like parties or union workers. And that is a bit special because usually it is an institution protest that do protest. At the beginning, it was really just for the material condition to can live decently. And then for the remaining, at least it evolved and in more leftist scenes, as there could be homophobia or racism at the beginning. In some parts, it was absolutely not the majority. And now, but there are still a lot of persons with a lot of individual ideas, and they will not all say they are communist or they are for an alternative capitalism. There is just the common scene that is improving material condition, especially for the poor, but there is no definitive solution to arrive if it is just a social capitalism or communism or something else. And there is no... We are a unit by the problem of the system, but not for exactly what how far we want to go. And there is no consensus of that in the movement.
Can you maybe tell something about the political situation in the society, the Macron government and so on, that framed this ignition of the Gilets Jaunes protest?
Basically, it's what is mostly called neoliberalism, that is absolutely not French-specific, and that causes problems in other countries of the world. It attacks worker conditions, their salary, and it wants to go always deeper, and they are always concurrence. I don't know if it is a wide term in English, but say that in this country, workers have less rights, and so if we do not... reduce rights here, we will not be competitive, so we have to reduce rights, and we reduce rights, and then the other are not enough competitive, and they must also reduce rights, etc., etc., and we are always have to go worse in the current economic system. And so as there are more and more protests, the state tends to be more and more aggressive, and it is particularly true in France, but also in other countries, but in particular state in France, we are now in a state of urgency. Officially, we are not anymore, because most of the law that was for that, and that was intended for terrorism, have been put in the common rights. So it authorized a lot of things, and there are more and more laws to punish protesters, etc. Even some international organizations that are not left warn about police violence in France. But it goes on that the French is not punished, and a lot of people do not warn too much and just say on their TV... on their computer to watch films. And
yeah, I think you focused repression already now. Most listeners won't know the fact that the Gilets Jaunes are still out on the streets once a week, at least. There's a complete lack of media coverage on it. I think it's a fact that the French state isn't happy about it all. So can you maybe tell us a bit on how the movement developed from the beginning until today? And yeah, focusing both on the internal debate, how strategies and tactics changed by the movement, and how the strategies and tactics of the state changed, and how it reacted to the movement, like the means of repressions, both by the police and by politicians and media campaigns.
At the very beginning, it was identified as mostly very small bosses protest. So at the beginning, the media say, oh, it is very good, etc. And it fastly turned to be a proletarian protest, and then it was not good at all. Of course, it goes really fast, and it was powerful, but it was not enough to win a lot of things by the governments. There was a lot of repression, and there is still. The movement tends, unfortunately, to degrowth, and there is no specific tactic there, and there is no one record. There are different groups that say we should do that or we should not, etc. But there is no consensus that we should obey to this group or this other. There is no real organization, and it is a chance because there is no one that will control the movement. Or no organization that will control it, but in the other hand, we are a bit unorganized as Gilets Jaunes, or just some parts obey to the decision we have made in a meeting, and some others say, oh no, mais this meeting organization does not, we do not think it is relevant, so we don't care. Even if they could have, even if it is done in a democratic way, etc., there are problems like that. So,
there are demonstrations every Saturday.
Yeah,
but there are also assemblies in every city.
There are not protests every Saturday, at least not in all cities. There is this in Toulouse, but in most cities, unfortunately, it has stopped. And there is assemblies. But there are some persons do not recognize them, but it exists, and there will be the assemblies of assemblies very soon, the next week, if I remember well.
Coming back to repression, I think there are some numbers in the internet which are quite shocking. I think maybe you can say something about it.
I do not know the numbers, but there was some person put in prison, and there was a lot of person that was temporarily arrested by police, and really a lot, and there was also a lot of physical damage, eyes lost, hand lost, etc., and it was not necessary for the more biggest protest. It was also some regular protester, if you can say, and there can be no distinction of which people are attacked, even with this kind of hard damage. And this is really, with the Gilets Jaunes protest, it was really a step further than it was before. There is a flashbulb that is like a gun, but it is not exactly the same weapon, but it can really harm a lot. People that lose eyes lost it due to this weapon, so it is absolutely not just a defensive thing, like they say. There is a lacrimogen, it is gases. It's hard, you have a problem to the eyes and to... in the nose, in the mouth, so it is really not pleasant, and you want to go away generally when you receive that. And there is a thing that explodes to that can harm also the foods, etc. And so there are mostly three types of weapons, and there are two types of policemen, the CRS that are not the most dangerous, and the bike that is really dangerous and then can also attack with a bat, and they are the most dangerous, and when they are there we have to be really careful.
I think also the quite famous, we know them from Greece, this Delta units also got established here, this motorcycle.
It is the bikes of the most dangerous that use motorcycle. It was forbidden in the past because I don't remember, it was a lot of years ago, but there was a big problem, a death maybe, I don't remember exactly, and they have authorized it again. It is one of the steps to go deeper in the repression, so it is unfortunately not so surprising.
As we heard, a lot of people from the movement face a lot of this repression, get harmed, get imprisoned, and so on. And on the other hand, there is not so much organization of the movement. Can you maybe say something about how people deal with repression, if there is some support organization?
Yeah, there is what we call a defense collective. So it is a collective defense. That is a small group that do the work for helping people to say what to do if they are arrested, and to support persons that are already in prison. So that is a group that works well.
Yeah, I think you already mentioned that the beginning were a bit problematic of the movements, and it wasn't so clear in which direction it would move, especially because we saw this popular protest movements in other European countries, where they showed a very strong chauvinistic, racist, homophobic and so forth tendency, and was also moving towards the right, and also like used and organized more and more by the organized right. And also the Gilets Jaunes were accused in the beginning to be a platform for right-winged actors. Like, I think there was an attack on a Jewish person that got covered a lot in the media. And I think it's also used as a means of blackmailing the movement in the media, saying that it's like populist right-wing or something. Can you say something about these accusations, and what's the point of the movement about this?
It's true that generally when there are the material problems, that there is always the risk of that it goes to hard right. And there was a bit of the right in the beginning, some ideas of the right, and including ideas from Front National, that is the hard right in French, hard right party. But it evolved, and now all the people that are Gilets Jaunes are left. So it is clearly not win in the movement.
And so if right-wing people come, they are pushed out of the movement?
I think there was a lot of... Now it is less the case because there is less a problem, but we say in the protest, no fascists, so... The movement, by what he tries sometimes, was explicit that he does not want fascism, this kind of thing. But apparently they do not come anymore. Now, at least in Toulouse, it may be different in some other cities, but...
To talk about the future a bit, as you actively support the movement and put a lot of effort in its success, what sort of perspectives do you see for the future of the Gilets Jaunes movement and like other movements, or an increasing of the political situation in France?
Currently, it tendentially degrows, unfortunately, the movement. So I think he will fail to change the situation only by its own. It highlights the state repression, and it shows that there are a lot of people that want a change in the left direction of the political... And I think that it was a good thing that there are a lot of protesters that stopped to watch TV, or that were more clever, if it is not a good word, but that changed politically, and that is really a good thing, and it will be useful for the next thing that will arrive to be enough big to threaten a lot the government, and because currently it threatens it, but not just because it can... maybe one day be again bigger. If it stays at the current size, it is not enough, clearly. It is nearly 1 year that now the movement exists. And okay, if it was really dangerous for the government, as it is currently, the government won't be there anymore. So
you said you're a syndicalist?
Yeah.
Did this movement have any impact on the syndicates? Like, did more people join maybe radical syndicates? Or were the syndicates also thinking about supporting the movement?
At the very beginning, one of the biggest left syndicats failed to say that, oh, it was only racism, etc., even if there was a bit of that, but it was not possible to sum up with justice. There was a lot of other things, and people in the Gilets Jaunes movement think a lot that union workers organization have killed some previous protests, so they generally do not like union workers organization, even if they have generally no problem with the basis of union workers. Generally they condemn syndicalism entirely, and sometimes not know radical syndicalism like the CNT in France or in Spain. And so, no, there are not a lot of recruits from Gilets Jaunes movement in this type of organization, or at least in Toulouse, maybe in other cities, but I guess not for the same reason. Maybe just a bit, but not much.
Has normality returned to Chile? No! Social peace? Not that either. The people don't want peace without dignity. To borrow a phrase from the Situationists, the people don't want the peace of the graveyard. Okay, maybe it's not all of the people, but it's important to understand that it isn't only the tens of thousands who fill the center of Santiago daily. All around the city, you find pockets of creative resistance. A march blocking traffic here, a student-led fare evasion there, clever, inspiring graffiti everywhere. Hatred of the police has pretty much generalized. On Sunday, I saw police directing traffic at a critical intersection downtown. Everyone was yelling at the police. Drivers shouted from their car windows or honked the horn in that 1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1-2-3 rhythm that permeates the whole city. People got off their bikes to stand and hurl abuses at the police. I saw a father holding his young daughter's hand and using the other to flip off and point at the cops. Everyone on the sidewalk was whistling and booing at noon on a Sunday. A few days earlier, I was at a main shopping street downtown, and a small circus act was setting up. They put on a playlist of music while they got ready, and one of the songs was this well-known anti-police cumbia that has been an anthem of the demonstrations. Most of the block began to sing along, especially the street vendors. So I wouldn't say that normality has returned. However, a kind of functionality, at least in Santiago, has. It's important to note that while a third of Chile's population lives in the Santiago region, and thus most of the news channels and media focus on what happens there, there have been conflicts and demonstrations all over Chile, with varying levels of repression that go mostly unreported. I'm in Santiago, so I'll tell you what I know here. The majority of metro stations are in operation, and buses are running somewhat normally, although less frequently in the evenings. And after 4 in the afternoon, all routes avoid Plaza Italia, which had previously been a major bus thoroughfare. Lots of people go to work in the day, and then head downtown for the protests in the evening. Events with big crowds, which had been prohibited during the week of martial law, have slowly been coming back, kind of. There have been plenty of big concerts and large indoor theaters, and there's more and more nightlife, but stadium events are another story. On Friday, November 22nd, professional soccer returned, with the first match in over a month. However, due to rowdy demonstrations outside the stadium, they closed the doors to the public. The first soccer game since the revolt began was played in the eerie ambiance of an empty stadium, with only a few league businessmen and family members watching. The demonstrators making a fuss outside were actually soccer hooligans. Just like in the Egyptian Revolution of 2011 and the Gezi Park Uprising in Istanbul in 2013, soccer hooligans have been on the front lines of many of the confrontations with the police. And there's a previously unimaginable alliance between the different fan clubs. If you've seen any epic photos of demonstrators atop the monument in Plaza de la Dignidad, that's what Plaza Italia is now known as, you can probably spot a few soccer hooligan fan club flags. About halfway through the match, the hooligans actually managed to break into the stadium and cause the game to be canceled. Social media praised the hooligans for not allowing a distracting spectacle to take place while people should be in the streets. But it wasn't only the hooligans who showed solidarity with the demonstrations. Before the game, both teams held up a banner reading, "For a More Just Chile." And the players from one team lined up, with each player covering one eye, in recognition of the more than 200 eyes that have been lost due to the pellets that the police are shooting at demonstrators. Allow me to make a weird little aside about large events and concerts here. Iron Maiden played just a couple of days before the first weekend of rioting and martial law, and there are still Iron Maiden shirts everywhere. Honestly, it was probably one of the last events for a long time in which rich and poor, right and left, supporters and opponents of Pinochet could peaceably gather together in the thousands. Now, most of the rich have locked themselves up in their gated neighborhoods towards the majestic Cordillera, the Andean mountain range. Although even in the rich neighborhoods, casserolas and chants and demonstrations echo throughout the tiled interiors of the malls that have only recently reopened their doors. At this point, the rich right-wingers have changed out their t-shirts for ties. Those that you see on the streets, that is. I'm told that the rich here have cars. They don't depend on the mass transit system whose steep fares started this whole thing. However, in the still gritty downtown of Santiago Centro, Eddie the Head is very, very presente. Some of the people in Iron Maiden gear seem to have not taken it off since the concert. They're covered in calcified layers of that chalky water and baking soda mix that everyone uses to survive the tear gas. Their shirts are torn up from hurtling tear gas canisters and tripping when they're running from the police and the occasional friendly fire of stones. The real rockers are in the streets. Run for the hills, you bougie motherfuckers. While the future of large mainstream events remains uncertain, countercultural events are flourishing. And I'm intentionally using the word counterculture instead of subculture, because there's a level of participation that cuts across social divisions. On Sunday, November 24th, there were over 10 open-air concerts in plazas and parks all over Santiago, each with different kinds of music, activities like banner making and speakers and discussions about the movement. While anarchists here roll their eyes at the popular slogan, Chile has awoken, there is, nevertheless, a kind of awakening that's marked by the creativity and cultural activity happening. Some anarcho-punks have taken to calling it post-Chile. If anything, there's a new kind of normality, a new routine for many of us. Put a flag on your car or your bike, beat out the 1-2-1-2-3 rhythm on a pan while you walk somewhere, check the memes and the counter info on your phone before you go to bed, and protest every day, starting at 5 p.m. at Plaza de la Dignidad. It's not just daily routines either. By this point, everyone knows that Fridays have the biggest crowds. This past Friday was especially big and especially combative. The most notable thing that happened requires a little bit of explanation. First, the conflicts on Alameda, the main boulevard, have different focal points. One of them is in front of the monument to police officers who died in the line of duty. The police treat it as their fort to defend, partially because behind the monument is the police officer's church. Cops get married there, funerals for dead cops take place there. They have a true, albeit disgusting, connection to the place. Which is to say that it's hard to tell whether they chose it out of self-interest or strategy. Secondly, it's important to understand the lines of combat. A kind of division of labor has arisen on Alameda. In the first line, you have shields. In the second line, stones, Molotovs, and slingshots. The third line has a few different tasks. Medics with stretchers, the people who extinguish tear gas and buckets of water, and the people who bring the stones to the second line from the fourth line. Because in the fourth line, you have, well, here they're called miners. Basically, the people who break up the sidewalk into throwable pieces. Fourth line is also where you'll find people with spray bottles with water and baking soda to spray on the face of anyone who got tear gassed. Although at this point, between the use of gas masks and the people dunking the canisters into buckets of water, the tear gas doesn't do much anymore. Oh, and then in the fifth line, you got everyone with their lasers pointing over the heads of all the preceding lines of combat. There's a true reverence for the first few lines. When someone extinguishes a tear gas can, everyone applauds. There are videos of normal citizens cheering on young first-liners with their shields as they head to the front of the demonstration. All of this is to say that on Friday, November 22nd, something happened that had not happened yet in any of the protests in Santiago. The lines of combat withstood the police long enough that the police ran out of ammunition. Or at least they were conserving it. They were shooting tear gas and pellets, but much, much less frequently than normal. Once everyone realized this, a strange low bellow resonated through the crowd, growing into a stirring roar as encapuchados rushed forward, breaking through the fences in front of the monument for the first time yet, and taking the monument. It got doused in paint and marbled tiles were pulled off and broken into projectiles thrown at the very same cops the monument was built to honor. The police, without much ammunition, took to hurling stones back at the demonstrators. But thanks to the first line and their shields, masked demonstrators were able to hold their position for a long time. Okay, permit me an aside here about the shields. One of the favorite materials for making shields out of is old satellite dishes. Try to think about it from Dishy's point of view. 20 years ago or so, a working Chilean with a little bit of extra money thought, hey, things are going well for me. I've got a little extra income with this whole newfangled democracy thing we've got going on. How about I treat myself to a few dozen or a few hundred extra channels as a nightly distraction from my alienating existence? So, Dishy got installed and connected to a family. But then things changed. The money stopped flowing, and at some point, Dishy's human stopped paying the bills, and the channels stopped coming through. Dishy got lonely. They went from a few electrifying years of bringing smiles, however opiated, onto the faces of a whole family, to then just sitting and gathering dust for decades. When suddenly, one day, in November 2019... Wait, is that the child Dishy used to show programs like The Simpsons and 31 Minutos to? Why, it is. But she's all grown up now. And why is she taking Dishy apart? Oh my goodness! Are we going for a stroll through the city? Look at all these other Dishies and humans! And they're smiling just like we used to while watching The Simpsons together. In fact, there's tons of Simpsons characters all around them on signs saying things like, "Me so hungry for Pinera's blood!" There's other characters Dishy used to transmit also. Pikachu, Vegeta, and even Spider-Man. Although this Spider-Man is somehow stupider, but sexier? Wait, what the fuck? Who are these monsters in faceless green uniforms? Thinks Dishy. They look just like the stormtroopers from that one movie they always showed on Channel 254. What was it called? Star Wars and... No! No, they're shooting! They're shooting at the child who grew up watching the shows I transmitted! You fucking murderers! Child, hold me up! I shall protect you! Anyway, these satellite dishes are the discarded remains of upwardly mobile ambitions, left as useless trash in the city, but now on the front lines, just like the rest of us. After watching people take the cop monument on Friday, I just walked around. When the crowds are that massive, you can't know all of what's happening without going for a stroll. The conflict is decentralized, with multiple points of confrontation, but also meaningful acts of memory and dignity. Across the street from the cop monument, there's an arts center under renovation. People broke into the construction site and hauled out material for the burning barricades. But I just sat on top of a scaffolding and watched everything unfold from up on high. However, even higher up, someone managed to get on the roof of the building, and they were playing surveillance camera whack-a-mole with a long piece of rebar from the construction site. Down below, responsible encapuchados made a barrier on the sidewalk to make sure no one was in harm's way in case the rebar fell. It didn't feel right to sit still, though, so I went down and danced with others in a circle stomping around a fire, chanting for very bad things to happen to the president and the police. As I left the circle dance, I saw a stream of people leaving the art center with more material for the fire. One encapuchado in full block had a globe in their hands, surely looted from some desk in the art center. I know there are tons of beautiful things I've seen in the past few weeks here that I will surely forget, or maybe I've even forgotten them by now, but I will never forget seeing that masked figure with the globe in their hands, illuminated by the fire of the barricade, not ruling the world, but freeing it. They didn't burn the globe, if that's what you're thinking. And I'd like to imagine they took it back to the Autonomous Education Project and their Poblacion. But who will ever know? I kept on strolling, and a block away, a hot dog cart was blasting the punk rock sing-along of Dos Minutos in the synth-pop anthems of Los Prisioneros. Everyone sang along. Another block away, a saxophonist belted out Bella Ciao while encapuchados hurled rocks and burnt barricades at another point of confrontation with the police. Finally, I made it to the Plaza de la Dignidad, full of people drinking, lasering the police, and chanting at the top of their lungs. Fireworks shot into the sky as the sun set. Next to the statue, there was a small pocket of somber, quieter people, all wearing the same shirt with a portrait of a smiling man. They were the friends and family of a demonstrator who died a week earlier, when the cops cleared the demonstrators. He fell from the horse statue in the middle of the plaza, and while Red Cross medics were resuscitating him, the police continued to shoot tear gas and water cannons directly at the Red Cross volunteers around him. That's how he died. And if it hadn't been for the police, he could have lived. It was beautiful seeing his loved ones there, keeping his memory alive, and reminding the demonstrators of one more reason to take the power away from the police as soon as we possibly can. Eventually, the plaza got cleared this last Friday, too, just like every night. But this time, just as the cops cleared the plaza, a procession of at least 100 motorcycles rolled in from the east, swooping in like the eagles in The Hobbit and interrupting the police. They rolled in circles around the plaza and held up police as people got away. It was significant that the Friday, November 22nd demonstrations were so large, because for the week prior, I actually believed that things were slowing down. There were three specific dates that led me to believe that. On November 18th, the movement celebrated 1 month since the first night of riots that kicked everything off. November 14th, likewise, was hyped up to be a big date of conflicts because it marked 1 year from a scandal in which the police shot Camilo Catrillanca, a Mapuche activist and villager, in the back, killing him. Neither date saw that many people in the streets, by which I mean there were only tens of thousands rather than hundreds of thousands. But still, it seemed like things were quieting down. I was worried it also had to do with an announcement Piñera made on the 12th, saying that in April 2020 there would be a plebiscite for a new constitution, which is something totally historic. The constitution in place now has been amended since democracy returned in the 1990s, but it's fundamentally the same constitution that was written from scratch in 1980, in the middle of the military dictatorship. Then, on November 15th, a majority of the parties in the Congress approved a more specific deal for how the plebiscite will be run, calling the deal the Agreement for Social Peace. There was some anxiety in the movement that this concession would finally placate a critical mass of people in the streets. Some of the popular assemblies and cabildos, or colonial-style councils, started to orient their discussions around a new constitution. Even some politicians were encouraging cabildos. I was nervous that what Piñera couldn't achieve with the iron fist of the military, he was achieving with the velvet glove of democratic potential. I was wrong, though. The most important slogan of the movement rose to the surface again, just like it had with previous concessions, like Piñera's table scrap social reforms, the canceling of the metro fare hike, and when he fired his cabinet. Aún no ganamos nada, or we have won nothing yet. Basically, a call to keep filling the streets, to not settle for scraps, to keep fighting for dignity. There's a spectrum of opinions within the movement about the demand for a constitutional assembly. Most anarchists, for example, see it as a distraction and a way for the state to recuperate the legitimacy that it has lost. On the other hand, I think Piñera's announcement did actually surprise people and give them a sense of their power. A plebiscite to decide whether people wanted a new constitution is totally historic. That wasn't even on the table during the 1988 plebiscite that ended the dictatorship. However, I think most of the popular assemblies and people in the streets, including some anarchists, see the process Piñera proposed as illegitimate because they don't see it as leading to a true constitutional assembly. And a true constitutional assembly means all kinds of different things to different people. Just to give you a taste of what this sounds like, here's the communique about rejecting the Agreement for Social Peace from the Neighborhood Assembly in Plaza Bogotá. We wholly reject this agreement. The content and proposal of this illegitimate agreement do not seem motivated towards generating a constitutional process that is representative and participatory for the people. Rather, it simply reproduces the old form of making deals that benefit the elite. We do not accept any constitutional process that doesn't work towards truth and justice. We say no to impunity. We demand that President Piñera step down immediately, having been the chief politician responsible for multiple violations of human rights. Our assembly considers any agreement without a solution for the current needs of justice and dignity to be an illegitimate agreement. We will self-organize a people's plebiscite in coordination with other regions and neighborhoods. We will work to build horizontal links of organization and coordination with other self-organized popular assemblies toward the goal of holding a people's plebiscite that can be carried out in different areas, and through this, we can freely and sovereignly self-determine what it is the people actually want in a new constitution. We will not give up the streets. We will keep protesting actively in our territory, since we believe that the struggle must go on in order to demonstrate our rejection of the imposition of the state in its institutions onto the current process of social constitution in the streets. We call on the people to reject this agreement, in which we weren't invited to participate or form, which is presented to us today as an exit from conflict. Furthermore, we call on people to join this call for an autonomous plebiscite throughout the territories as an exercise of our own independent power, until dignity becomes the custom. As an anarchist, there are some things I agree with in this communique and some things I don't, and surely there were even other anarchists who helped shape the communique. Overall, though, I wish more of the assemblies were oriented towards things we can do rather than what we think about ongoing issues. Because when it comes to ideology, we'll never all agree. The assembly in my neighborhood has Trotskyists, anarchists, liberals, and those identities aren't changing anytime soon. And whenever we talk about what needs to happen with the Constitutional Assembly, it's just a broken record of grand schemes for social change. Instead, I wish we were discussing things like, if martial law is declared again, what will we do? What is our neighborhood's policy on looting? Like, maybe immigrants and mothers get first pick? How do we stop our neighbors from getting evicted? When something big goes down, where do we gather? Orienting the discussions around breaking the law together rather than shaping the law. The communique about the plebiscite does call for the most important thing, however, which is not giving up the streets in light of the agreement for social peace. Peace has become the right-wing talking point. It's telling that the only talking point the right believes can serve them and that might have some social legitimacy anymore is essentially a liberal one. The government is trying so hard, but so much in vain, to return to normality, whereas people in the streets know that the only reason the fare hike was canceled, the only reason the military was taken off the streets, the only reason the new constitution is being explored at all, is because people are fucking shit up. The right-wing and liberal fixation on peace is also a way they try to divide the movement between peaceful protesters and so-called violent protesters. But I can tell you that on the streets, that division doesn't really exist. You wouldn't know it, though, from watching TV. Piñera makes speeches almost weekly saying the same bullshit. We need social peace to ensure justice, to make change, blah, 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 blah. But Friday, November 22nd proved that no one's buying it. I used to await Piñera's speeches with worry and fear about the next repressive measure to come. And sure, he still promises repression. He promises more cops and proposes laws against masking or laws making it easier to bring out the military. But I no longer see his speeches as acts of strength, but acts of weakness. He's lashing out. If there is anything that will slow things down, it's the summer. In October, things were still cool and the sun set relatively early. Now, the sun sets late and it gets hot in the daytime. In fact, I think one reason Friday was so big is because it was finally a cooler day. Blocking up was a little more comfortable. However, if things die down for a few months, I believe they will only start back up again when everyone sees what a total sham the constitutional plebiscite in April 2020 will be. The task for anarchists now is to expose the sham of democracy and to propose revolutionary alternatives. So far, this has been an insurrection. But I believe in April, we might have a chance at a real revolution. The last thing I want to end on is I asked a friend about what I should include in this report for people outside of Chile to know. Her response was soberingly simple. You need to know the police continue to kill, continue to rape, continue to shoot out people's eyes. They continue to repress, and they continue to uphold a system that keeps people poor, desperate, and competing against each other. The system they uphold murders the poor, it murders the earth, and it murders those who stand up for the dignity of either. the deadly week of martial law was a rare, short-lived glimpse of the state at its core. If we fail at revolution, it will be that same version of the state that comes back again and again and again. This is a struggle for survival.
¿Qué es lo que con qué fue? Andamos con los flightes. Andamos con los flightes.
You are listening Angry Voices from Athens by Radio Zones of Subversive Expression, December 2019.
Demonstrations. The past month, two main demonstrations took place in most Greek cities on the 17th of November for the celebration of the 46 years after the uprising in National Technical University of Athens against the army of Huda back in 1973. The demonstration in Athens was the biggest in numbers for the past years. After the demonstration ended, riots started in most cities with the repression of security forces. On the 6th of December, in memory of the murder of Alexis Grigoropoulos by a cop on 2008, the second biggest demonstration took place in most Greek cities. After the demonstration, riots started in most cities, while in Athens, Thessaloniki and Patra, the repression were severe, many injured by the authority forces and their violations. As a response, looting actions took place in 21 different spots in Athens, for which different anti-authoritarian groups took responsibility. In Patras, the fifth largest city in the country, the arrested demonstrators were held as prisoners for 2 days, leading to raids on the town, Law Hall, as a message of solidarity. Solidarity actions for the arrested took place in every case. On the 28th of November, a demonstration in solidarity with the Chilean people took place in Athens. On Saturday, 23rd of November, a solidarity demonstration was held with anarchist Christopher Cortesis and the other persecuted companions for the case that jailed Cortesis for trying to expropriate products from the multinational Leroy Merlin store, where he was honored by the security company of it and the court clerk. Throughout the past month, many demonstrations in solidarity with the occupations took place in Athens and other cities.
15 days before the anniversary of December of 2008, the Ministry of Defense issued a final warning through the media about occupied buildings and the places of social fights. The Telegraph said that within 15 days, all occupations must be abandoned and occupiers must arrange rentals with the owners of the occupant buildings. We were not told what would happen if we did otherwise, letting scenarios float in the air to cause terror. Today, several days after the deadline, everyday events show us what power has gone through the minds of the security forces, to the idea of terrorism, to those who do not accept neoliberalism, social injustice and authoritarian power.
Hello, and here is Radiofragmata's contribution for December 2019. It has been some time since our last bad news report, so let's start. New Democracy came into power in July 2019. They came following 5 years of the left-wing Syriza government and gained power through the narrative and commitment to avenge the so-called failures of the left administration. Immediately coming into power, they started their regime with two intense provocations, signaling as to what will come. First, they released the cop Epaminondas Korkoneas, who murdered Alexis Grigoropoulos. The 15-year-old comrade who was killed by this bastard in 2008, sparking an uprising across Greece and solidarity actions and events across the world. Following this provocation, they established the end of the university asylum laws in Greece, formally in writing. While Syriza evacuated enough squads during their reign, New Democracy came to power in light of a commitment to evacuate every squad in Greece and restore the center and overall city of Athens to a time where law and order prevailed. First, they went after the immigrants and refugees. On August 26, they evacuated the squads known as Spirou Trikoupi 15 and 17, Gare and Rosa de Foc. During this evacuation, specifically of the two squads on Spiro Trikoupi, over 150 refugees and immigrants were taken into custody, including many children. Some were moved to detention centers and concentration camps, scattered across Athens and broader Greece. However, it has been said that due to overcrowding, many ended up back on the streets without shelter. The self-determined squads providing a safe space for immigrants to reside are now empty and unused, guarded by riot police and with bricks filling all the doors and windows. Following this attack on the 26th, primarily immigrant squads for housing were attacked. Hotel Oniro, the 5th School of Exarchia, and an unnamed squad around Omonia were all evacuated, resulting in the displacement of over 500 refugees and immigrants. New Democracy intends to build more concentration camps for refugees out of the view of tourists. Additionally, to direct funds and change existing laws to complicate asylum requests from refugees. They have declared war on anarchists and immigrants, using this rhetoric to distract Greek society from its bigger issues, a classic fascist strategy throughout history. Now that many of the bigger squads for immigrants in the center of Athens has been evacuated, they're turning to more specifically anarchist squads. On November 2nd, the 14-year-old squad known as Vancouver Apartman, located near the Economics School of Athens, was evacuated, resulting in 4 arrests, complete destruction of the interior, kidnapping of dogs, and boarding up the building with cats inside, not allowing for their owners to find a safe place for them. It wasn't until immense legal pressure and the hunger strike of an animal liberationist that the cops allowed someone to rescue the cats inside. Outside of Athens, the squad Palmares was evacuated in Larissa. Attempts to restore the Libertatia squad in Thessaloniki after fascist attacks in January 2018 burned the squad down have been interrupted by police as well. The government has intensely increased the police very quickly with specific intentions of tackling the immigrant communities of Athens and crushing the anarchist and squatter movements. The Delta Police, who are roving motorbike police used to beat and terrify demonstrators, was entered by Syriza following the rise to power. However, 300 new Delta Police have been established to prey on the center of Athens. New Democracy has also created a new police force inside the subways and tourist areas of Athens. Embarrassingly enough, they are called the Black Panthers, because they were all black. Transportation regulation and enforcement of fares has become more strict in recent times, and now there is a police force for this reason alone. The MAD police, which are the riot police unit used for demonstrations to guard evacuated squads against re-evacuation and surround the neighborhood of Exarchia every day, has also been increased by 1,500 members. Significant changes in repression are also being made in new policies. Changing the minimum amount of time for those sentenced on terrorism charges from 16 to 22 years being one example. Threatening conditions of release and penalties for violations of probation. Increasing penalties for accusation of rioting or use of Molotov cocktails. Threatening trespassing laws targeting specifically protests that are unlawfully enter buildings, taking away the rights of prisoners, and even creating new opportunities to punish those advocating on reporting on resistance to the state or economy. They are truly trying to modernize and advance state repression in order to compare with such governments of extreme repression and surveillance, such as the United States and many more in the world. On November 8, police carried out anti-terror raids targeting over a dozen houses alleged to be the residences of anarchists connected to the group Revolutionary Self-Defense. The authorities claimed to have seized an array of weapons, including guns used in prior attacks against the Mexican embassy and the headquarters of PASOK, the Socialist Party, which is the location of one of the main stations of the MAD riot police in Exarchia. Police arrested 3 people in 3 raids. It's likely that they will experiment with the new punitive measures in prosecuting them. Now, a few things about some political prisoners in Greece. Konstantinos Yatzoglou continues to be held without any legal updates in his case. He is currently being held in Korydallos on charges of sending letter bombs to various political elites across Europe. However, he claims his innocence and that he has been targeted and framed by the state. Christoforos Kortesis is currently in prison for the alleged attempt theft of 180 euros in equipment from a company called Leroy Merlin. This is the same company whose boss hit and killed 2 people and injured one more with his boat last summer in Greece and was set free once paying some thousands of euros in damages. Christoforos Kortesis is a well-known anarchist in Greece. Many believe that the charges are being exaggerated in order to repress him as an anarchist. He was arrested in mid-July and is in prison awaiting trial. He was previously in prison for alleged connections to revolutionary struggle, which we imagine had led to this opportunistic confinement of him by the state. In June 2019, the following anarchists were arrested in a police sting in Thessaloniki. Kostas Sakas, Yannis Dimitrakis and Dimitra Sirianou were arrested on June 12th. They were attempting to rob security guards that were replacing cash inside of an ATM machine. The theft was intended to gain funds for the movement and to support political prisoners. They were followed and spied on extensively before this arrest. The state awaited for them to commit the act and arrested them while observing them. Sakas was previously imprisoned for alleged involvement in revolutionary struggle and had most likely been under extensive surveillance since his release. Sakas and Dimitrakis are both in prison awaiting trial, while Dimitra is out on supervised house arrest. Nikos Romanos, who was imprisoned for supposed banks and post office robberies, was released after 6 years. He was arrested in February 2013 along with 3 companions for attempted armed robbery at the Agricultural Bank and TT Hellenic Post Bank in Velvendo, Kozani. Nikos was the best friend of Alexis Grigoropoulos, who witnessed his death. Most of the members of the group Conspiracy Cells of Fire were also released in recent months. Now, in solidarity with the world, a solidarity campaign is ongoing with the Evade movement of Chile. We have had demonstrations and concentrations in the center of Athens and at the Chilean embassy. There have also been clashes with the police in solidarity with those resisting in Chile. More events and actions are most likely to come as we feel inspired and send our strongest solidarity to those struggling in the streets of Chile. May the social war there go beyond all borders. There has also been consistent demonstrations, graffiti and banner campaigns in support of Rojava. Now, some more news about the anti-fascist movement in Greece. The neo-Nazi group Golden Dawn currently still stands trial for the murder of Kilapi in 2013. While they are on trial and have been voted out of parliament, their disgusting presence still exists. Even amidst all this repression to the anarchist movement, their offices were attacked in an intense display of courage. In the beginning of November, some individuals climbed a ladder in the night at their main offices and smashed the front window, leaving multiple gas bombs. Damage was done to their offices. Following the attack, the nearby police clashed those in a car chase around the center. Those fleeing the cops were able to escape, while the police chasing them had crashed and been injured. Also, at the beginning of November, some of the first Delta police deployed to Exarchia were attacked. A motorbike was blown up and one of the bastards suffered injuries. In response, both the Delta and MAD police waged war on Exarchia. They arrested over 15 people at random, attempted to raid a cafe frequented by anarchists, assaulted various random people in the streets, and shot tear gas across the neighborhood aimlessly. those responsible have not been caught. Following the formal abolition of the university asylum policy, police have entered universities such as the School of Economics in Kipseli to evict the occupied social centers known as stekis. Police are threatening the stekis they have not evicted and are pressuring university administrators to let them invade the campuses. The anarchist stekis of the economics school has since been reoccupied, though. Demonstrations continue to occur, with small clashes erupting despite the unrelenting assault from all sides. On the 17th of November, the day recommemorating the 24 students murdered by the junta in 1973, a daytime demonstration that went to the US Embassy saw one of the largest presences. A lot of anarchists participated in the march in two blocks. Police isolated the larger of the blocks from the rest of the march, with lines of 500 or more riot police walking on both sides of the demonstrators. In anticipation of the traditional night riots around the Polytechnic in Exarchia, police completely militarized the neighborhood. Roving groups of Delta police operated in groups of 10, while hundreds of riot police surrounded the neighborhood. In the past, when operations like this took place, anarchists took the roofs of Exarchia to fight the police. This year, equipped with drones and new anti-terror measures that enable police to enter buildings without regard for the law, police arrested six individuals and accused them of planning attacks from the roofs. Amid all this terrifying posturing from the state, despite the odds against them, a few hundred courageous individuals still took the square of Exarchia and tried to fight their way through the police to access the blocked-off Polytechnic. Additional massive numbers of riot police and Delta police bombarded them with tear gas and stun grenades. An array of videos show officers inflicting heinous beatings to people at random. Many people were seriously injured and currently face intense charge. We know of 28 arrests in Athens on November 17, 6 during preemptive daytime measures and 22 during night clashes. At least 31 more people were arrested across Greece as demonstrations involving anarchists occurred in Thessaloniki, Patras, Heraklio and other cities. The following day, police brutally attacked a march organized in solidarity with the arrests. On November 20th, the so-called Ministry of Citizen Protection officially gave all squads remaining in Greece 15 days' notice to evacuate or face forceful eviction. In the statement, they tell occupiers to contact the owners to make lease agreements and allege that immigrants will be moved to inland accommodations. While most squatted buildings are owned by the state, even in cases in which the owners have not made moves to evict squatters, government officials have pressured them or fabricated justifications for eviction, such as accusation of drug dealing or weapon making. Considering that most squads maintain strict anti-drug policies and are clearly aware enough of the risk of imminent raids to know the risk of manufacturing weapons, these accusations are blatantly dishonest. Fabrication like this also provide excuses to evict squads like Lelas that have been occupied for over 20 years, regardless of whether there is pressure for their owners or precise evidence of illegal activity. Under the prosecutors appointed by New Democracy, housing protection laws no longer pose any obstacle to the current regime. December 5th was supposed to be the deadline for all squads in Greece. The timing was no coincidence, as it was the day before the anniversary of the death of Alexis Grigoropoulos. From the first day of the threat until the deadline, squads across Greece organized daily events and coordinated actions and demonstrations across the country to manifest the strength of our movement and solidarity. Offices of New Democracy were also boarded up with bricks by anarchists, the same way they have assaulted our spaces. On the 6th of December, demonstrations took place across Greece. Demonstrations happened across the country. Some strong clashes took place in Patras and Thessaloniki, while a huge demonstration in Athens was met with extreme repression. In the morning of the 6th, an autonomous demonstration of anarchist student march, while being surrounded to all sides by the police and isolated from other leftist demonstrators. In the night, a huge demonstration marking the anniversary took place with thousands of anarchists attending. Once the demonstration began to end and went to Exarchia, police attacked the demonstration for Alexis brutally beating people at random. Video footage show the violence, and while it will lead to nothing, even the state has pretended to investigate into its own brutality. Across the country, facing ridiculous allegations by the state, everyone has been released since the 6th, though, and are awaiting trial. While the demonstration in Athens took place, clandestine acts happened across the city outside of Exarchia. In 13 neighborhoods of Athens, around 30 state and capitalist targets were hit. At the moment, the deadline for the evacuation of all squads has ended. This new government does not seem to understand, though, that our solidarity and the spirit of the anarchist movement here goes beyond any material or superficial attack they could make on our infrastructure. We are among dark days of repression in Greece, but resilience and resistance are only growing stronger as we face these hard times and move forward in strength and solidarity. Cheers from so-called Greece, with love and rage. Radio Fragmata.